I thought it was interesting listening to Sam Walsh this morning saying that when Hammersley started up, their ambition was to get, was it 5 million tonnes, Sam? And you know, it's not often we get the opportunity to look back at where we've come from because we're just too busy doing our everyday thing. And I guess it's even less of an opportunity that we have to look forward. But I'd just like to start out today by casting back to about the 60s, just see where we've come from, and then cast forward 50 years and have a look at some of the issues for where we might want to get to. As Thomas already alluded to, these are my own views. They are not necessarily the views of the government. Whether they are or not is entirely up to the government, I haven't asked. But I take full responsibility for them. But if you go back to the 60s, that was really when the resources industry started out in Western Australia. Alcoa was just starting its bauxite mining in the Darling Range. Kambalda was discovered in 66 and turned Western Mining from a junior gold mining company to a major nickel company, and of course the iron ore mines were getting underway in the Pilbara. And in the 70s, I think the total production during that decade went from 50 million tonnes up to 100 million tonnes, which doubling of capacity must have seemed like quite a magnificent achievement at the time. As Sam said, that's a lot of dirt. But could anyone back then have thought that we would now be talking about perhaps 800 million tonnes or more coming out of the Pilbara? In the 80s, and I saw one of the stats that Reg put up this morning, I think we had $5 billion worth of total production back in the 80s. And that, of course, is when the North West Shelf was starting up and gas was coming into the marketplace. But interestingly, it was also the time when environmentalism was really starting to become a force, and I think that without wishing to open wounds, Kim, it was when there were certain problems with Wagerup and the forest. The 90s was the era of outsourcing, privatisation of government assets, when globalisation was really getting underway, turning into mega companies. And Indigenous issues really came on the radar screen for the resources industry, I think, when the Native Title Act came through. And here we are now in the 21st century, and if I saw the numbers that Reg put up, it's 53 billion tonnes of production, tenfold over that period since the 1980s, a tenfold increase in output. And the Australian economy is really running at full strap in just about any area you care to think of. Labour, water, energy, housing. Climate change has become a political issue as well as an environmental issue, and the world economy and certainly the Australian economy has become internationalised when you've got mortgage foreclosures in the US causing the sort of havoc that it is creating internationally. There's no doubt that we are very much in a globalised world. And the point of recapping like that is simply to say that we are now in a very different place in Western Australia that we were back in the 60s and even back in the 90s, that there has been so much change has occurred over that time, and the pace of that change is just going faster and faster day by day. The complexity of the issues, the uncertainty of the future, I think, is greater than it ever was before. And I think it's fair to say that governments are no longer in control of what happens inside their own borders. They are very much swept along by the tides of international change. So the lesson from all that, I think, should really be that if we look at the future through the prism of what we know now, what we are comfortable with now, then we're probably not going to see the real future. What we need to do is to challenge the current holy cows. We need to be creative and innovative in terms of what might come into the future. But above all else, I think we need to be agile in our planning and in our policy making, because the world is rapidly changing around us. So I've called this talk today, You Need to Plan for What You Plan to Become. And just in case there are any IP lawyers in the audience, I admit I've grabbed it off the TV. It's the NAB ad. I fully fess up to that, so please don't sue me. I'm a poor pensioner these days. There's no doubt that the resources industry has a very clear goal, a very clear vision for the future, and that is to get on the China wave and to ride that wave for as long as possible. And by its very investments that are occurring right now, it is leading the state and the nation towards that future. It was interesting to see a paper that was put out by this was the other Gano report that was done in August last year with Li Gong Song at ANU, and he said that in 20 years' time, China is likely to consume more energy and metals than all of the industrialized economies today. And I noticed one of the charts that Alan Kranzberg put up showed exactly that in the aluminium, that the entire world production, consumption by industrialized countries of aluminium will be chewed up by China in, was it 2020? No? 2070, yeah. So it's not an unrealistic scenario, but if you just stop and think for a moment as to what are the implications of that statement and the opportunities in that statement, and certainly the opportunities for Australia and WA if we get our policies and our plans right. But I would sound a word of caution that I think the industry needs to take the Australian community along with it, because, as I'm sure you're aware, not everyone is winning out of the China boom. We in Western Australia may think life is pretty good, but if you're on the East Coast, you would view life differently. When you've got the governor of the Reserve Bank referring to the high commodity price rises that were achieved just recently as being potentially destabilising, then I think we have an issue, because the rest of the community perhaps sees the resources sector gains as causing inflation, as causing interest rate pain and so on. And when house prices, petrol prices, food prices are going up, then I think we need to manage that prosperity, and that's a major challenge not just for governments, it's a major challenge also for industry, that we don't alienate people, because never forget, politicians are elected by the majority of the populace, not just by the resources fraternity, so should bear that in mind. But one of the fundamental questions for the future is in front of the Federal Treasurer right now, and I think Sam alluded to this, and that is whether it is in fact in Australia's interest, in our national interest, for our resources to be majority owned by sovereign funded customer countries. And I suppose the question that is being asked there is, would capital investment decisions, would commodity pricing decisions be made in favour of the customer, or would they be made in favour of Australia? So one of the issues that one of the fundamental issues for the future is, how comfortable is the Australian community with the ownership, foreign ownership of Australian resources by our customers? That's one policy issue that they're grappling with. The other diabolical issue, to use Garneau's word, is of course the issue of climate change, and the green paper that has just been released by Minister Penny Wong indicates that we are going to have an emissions trading scheme by 2010-ish, if you read today's paper, it's got an ish on the end of it, with some concessions made to energy-intensive export-exposed industries. But it's also very clear, if you read that paper, that there are limits on the largesse in there, and not all of the energy-intensive industries are going to be accommodated to the extent that they might like. So we really do need to adjust our thinking to these new policy realities. And I agree with Keith Spence this morning when Keith said the era of cheap energy in WA is over. I think any lingering ambitions we might have had here for energy-intensive transformation of our raw materials into value adding is now, has to be in serious doubt if it wasn't already a few years ago. I mean, how many companies are going to invest in energy-intensive activities like aluminium smelting, and I haven't asked Alan, with the uncertainty that there is about how cost-competitive they would be going forward. But on the positive side, let's assume that the stronger-for-longer scenario prevails and that Western Australia continues to be a major source of raw materials for China and India. Let us also assume that much of our resources are going to be located in remote and regional areas, and that's a pretty safe bet. Then I think in that scenario, WA is going to be faced with ongoing challenges of operating near the limit of capacity in the areas of certainly people, water, energy, and so on. And the key to our success is going to be the efficient use of those assets. And if we just look at our human assets as being the most fundamental, the MCA this week has released its forecast that there'll be another 48,000 workers required by 2020 in the WA minerals industry alone. And that's an 85% increase over where we are now. The CCI last year put out a prediction of 400,000 more workers being required in Western Australia over the coming decade. So regardless of what the number is, the numbers are large, and setting aside for the moment the issues around immigration and some of the community reaction that there might be to that, one of the first questions we have to ask ourselves is, where are we going to accommodate this expanded workforce? Do we envisage there's going to be one large living community, one large domicile to it, Perth, or are we going to house people in sustainable regional centres? And I use the word sustainable very deliberately, because companies wanting to attract staff into regions are going to require good levels of community services, good doctors, nurses, mechanics, hairdressers, baby minders, anything you care to name. And to get them there, there is going to have to be good levels of housing, hospitals, schools, sewage, water supplies, and so on. And I suppose in my mind that poses the question, do we want, indeed can we afford, the regional development as we currently know it? When it comes to community services, there's a general assumption that government should and will pay for the infrastructure. But the question to my mind is, what is the standard of schools and hospitals that should be expected that the taxpayer will pay for in these regional areas that are outside of the main population centres? And I think it's very unlikely that you're going, for example, to get a teaching hospital outside of Perth. And will the standard that is provided by government, and appropriately, in my view, provided by government, will that standard be high enough to attract the types of people that the resource companies want to attract into the regions? Or will they need to provide that extra level of service, such as the international school in Karratha? And will that just exacerbate the divide between the mining company staff and the non-mining company staff that already exists in those towns, and what will that do to the social structure of the town? So there's all of those issues, I think, that we need to think about in terms of regional development. There's also the physical factors. I mean, let's not delude ourselves that for all the best efforts we might make on greenhouse gas abatement, that really isn't going to change Australia's climate, because we're not in charge of our climate, the rest of the world is. So absent efforts by India and China to significantly change their emissions, I think we are stuck with climate change for the foreseeable future. And I think we need to think about what those changes might be. I know there's been some modelling done recently by CSIRO and by the Ag Department suggesting that the northwest is likely to be one of the areas of the greatest temperature rise in Australia. I think I saw a number of 4 degrees C by 2100. But there's also some other modelling that I've seen done that predicts that there are going to be significantly more severe cyclones over the years. Not necessarily more cyclones, but more severe cyclones in that part of the world. And we need to think through, before we start building substantial infrastructure in the regions, what's going to be the impact of that. So if we're seriously looking at building, for example, a northwest interconnected grid system, and you have severe cyclones coming through, how are you going to build it to withstand that? What impact is it actually going to have on the communities up there and on the pastoral industry and so on? And there's also, of course, the economic factor. If we assume that after the next 5 years, the transport industry is going to be carbon costed, then one of the questions is, what's it going to cost to transport people into the regions? What's it going to cost to service the regions? So I think there are all those issues when we are looking into the future, that before we make knee-jerk decisions, we really need to think 50 years out and think about what is the world that we will be in at that time. But importantly, how can we change these, or sorry, how can we turn these change circumstances into a competitive advantage for Australia and for WA in particular. And I think as a first step, one of the things that we might seriously look at is remote operating technologies in Western Australia, much as Rio Tinto is doing. Would this be one of the things that gives WA a competitive advantage in the 21st century over its competitors? If we really believe that an educated population is one of the competitive strengths that we have in WA, becoming a world-renowned centre for a technological centre for remote operations expertise is something that we might reasonably aspire to, notwithstanding the fact that I think the research centre is in Sydney, Sam, you mentioned.
One input.
One input, right. But of course, if the world suddenly embraces greenhouse gas abatement and tackles a target like 50 or 60% reduction over the next 40 years, then there is going to be an enormous amount of technological development that will be required in that time. And what is our competitive advantage there? What's our niche? We can talk about CO sequestration expertise, but what else is there that we could get into? And I think we need to be ready for that sort of flip-flop change that might come on us very quickly. But one of the things that we are certainly going to need is substantially more technology graduates from our universities than we have had in the last decade, and a substantially improved and a world-class communication system. I won't say any more on that, just read Mel Bryce's article in The West today. But because so much of the funding in those areas, in universities and communications and so forth, because so much of that funding actually comes out of the Commonwealth, out of the federal arena, we really need to bring the Commonwealth government along with us, to bring the Australian government and, in fact, the other states of Australia along with us in whatever vision we have for WA, because I think we're over there out of sight, out of mind to a large degree, and we don't figure in a lot of the policy thinking that that goes on. I suppose one of the other key issues that is on the minds of certainly the federal government, but governments and industry right throughout Australia, is the question of who is going to bear the risk of the infrastructure that we need going forward into the future if, in fact, many of our projects are to get off the ground and if we are to continue to service that that growing market in China and India. Who is going to pay for the railways, the water supplies, the power supplies, the transmission lines and so on? In fact, it's a good question. Who indeed is going to decide where they're going to be built, what's going to be built, and who pays for them? And Keith was raising the issue this morning about LNG hubs, and I think that's a very good case in point, that philosophically we could all, and in fact not even philosophically, but economically, you can see from the numbers that these make bloody good sense. But the question of who's going to decide where it is, who's going to run it, and a whole raft of those issues are things that we really need to come to grips with. And to a large degree, we need to recognise that these types of investments actually carry a lot of the completion risk and a lot of the market risk that the actual resource projects themselves bear. And in cases where you have to have economies of scale, where you've got multiple users, I can fully understand that that does make the financing of these things significantly more complex, because the bankers will want to have cross charges and goodness knows what else. But I think there is a real effort to be put in here to looking at what is going to be absolutely critical to our success in that area. I think, once again, the Midwest, the Okotie Port announcement that was made this week is a good example where there needed to be some rationale brought into the competing proposals that were out there, so that there was a single proposal that would be anointed, so it could be funded and brought forward. And it also, I think, brings up the question of the growing role potentially of independent infrastructure providers. But I think the actual role that they will play going forward is still a vexed question. I mean, the major commodity producers are still very much of the view that they want to own and control their own export infrastructure. And they commonly cite the problems in the coal terminals on the East Coast, the problems you get with open access infrastructure. We have also in the past in Western Australia experienced what, in essence, was a capital strike by the private sector when it had an argument with the regulator. And this was the situation with EPIC and the Dampier to Bunbury gas pipeline, where there was a critical piece of infrastructure there that the owner just wasn't putting capital into because they were at loggerheads with the regulator. So the funding, I think, of industrial infrastructure is a major policy challenge which is going to substantially impact on how successfully we can develop our resources in Australia, quite apart from the current financial crises that are going around the world. But these are just some of the policy issues that I think industry and governments, both state and federal, really need to come to a landing on in the relatively near future, because I'd suggest that as of today there's really no consensus view on these and probably a lot of other matters. And if we don't have these policy positions sorted out in advance, then it's very unlikely that you'll get the answer within the time frame of any one specific project. And there, I think, is the risk that you could lose a project because you haven't done the thinking in advance. The fact is that the companies are setting increasingly ambitious timeframes for their projects these days, understandably. And understandably, again, they are only interested in their particular project. And across the resources sector as a whole, what I observed in my previous role was that I think the growth brought on by the China syndrome is really outstripping all of our conventional planning horizons. We really haven't got processes in place to be able to deal with these issues in the time frame. Just a couple of simple examples. One is BHP Billiton Nickel West down at Hopetoun. Their housing needs in Hopetoun doubled during the period in which the project was being built. And all of a sudden, water availability became an issue for the houses down there. We have, at the other end of the spectrum, the competing issues of the Midwest iron ore producers, all having their own plans for what they wanted to do in the Midwest, all wanting to get into the market as quickly as possible. And what government sees is a hodgepodge array, and what the community sees is a hodgepodge array of multiple proposals by multiple companies wanting to develop different pieces of infrastructure at similar sites, and every one company is determined it's going to get on with its proposal, but we somehow or other need a mechanism for matching up the ambitions of the various developers with the broader vision, the broader ambition that perhaps the community and the government wants to see developed. So how do we actually achieve that consensus view? And to my mind, I think the solution really lies in setting a regional context so that we can agree broadly on what are the outcomes we are looking for in any one particular region. This framework would then allow companies to work up their own plans and investment strategies, and it also sets the big picture for both the companies and the community so that they have a sense of what's going to happen in that region over a reasonable period of time. And it also sets the context for the EPA, quite frankly, because the EPA cannot, by law, take into account anything other than the environmental impact of a project. It can't take the economics into account. The Environment Minister can, but there's no statutory process which provides the Environment Minister with economic or social advice. So I think these regional contexts, such as the Midwest Iron Ore Strategy, the exercise which is currently going on in the Kimberley with the Northern Development Task Force to find an LNG processing site, I think they are of very real benefit to not only industry but also to the communities, because in both of those regions, in both the Midwest and in the Kimberley, there are competing biodiversity values and competing resource and economic values, as well as major infrastructure decisions that need to be made. And you can only really make those decisions in the context of an holistic regional assessment where you gain a broad consensus across the community as to what are the economic, the social and the environmental outcomes that really must be achieved. I don't have time today to talk about the future that we might want to see for our indigenous communities, but that is a subject largely in itself. But it is certainly one of the other things that we need to take into account when we are looking at the regional futures in Western Australia. So, in conclusion, I would just like to come back to that question: what is it that we all want for the future of Western Australia? What do we want Western Australia to become over the next 50 years? And for my money, one of the strategic priorities of industry really should be to come to some understanding with governments and the broader community about what that future might be. The trouble is that that won't happen overnight, and given that the pressures that people both in industry and in government are under to deliver urgent approvals for projects that are here and now, there's a real risk that that important work will fall by the wayside, and it's going to take some substantial commitment of time and people by both sides to achieve that sustainable future planning framework that I think is going to carry the state forward, because it's only with a framework like that that you can move on to make decisions about infrastructure provision, where, who pays, and so on. What we're going to do about regional centres, where they're going to be, how much are we going to put into them, how big are they going to be, how do you actually make them sustainable. The support that might come from both industry and government for technology development and also for workforce development. So I think there is a substantial job of work to be done there, almost behind the scenes, in the backdrop to all the upfront stuff that is going on with project approvals and so forth that we hear about. As we heard this morning, there are fantastic opportunities, I think, for this state in the resources sector, both in terms of minerals and oil and gas. But really, it is now time for us to plan for what we plan to become.